Welcome to the National Self-Build and Renovation Centre. My name is Mike Hardwick, and I'm here to give you a guided tour of four of the educational zones here at the centre. The tour will give you an overall introduction to the processes involved when building your own home, and will cover plant and site setup, groundworks, building systems, and finally, roofing options. To begin the tour, please find your way to the plant and site setup zone pylon. It's beneath a big sign saying Start Educational Tour. Okay, we're ready to go. So here we are at the first of our four educational zones. This is all about construction, plant and site organisation, and I'm going to walk you through the important points. An efficient, well-run building project involves a considerable amount of research and planning. So the more organised you can be before the programme begins, the better chance you will have of a successful outcome. If you're at this point in your self-build journey, then you will have found your plot, you will have obtained full planning permission, and building control will be aware. Before starting anything on site, make sure that if there is a community infrastructure levy payable to your local authority, you have registered your claim for self-build exemption for any fees, and that you have submitted Form 6 to notify that you are about to start work. This is important, as failure to do so could remove your exemption. Also, make sure your insurance cover is in place. This should be a contractor's all-risk policy covering materials and plants on site, and employers and public liability for the duration of the contract. It's also a good idea to notify your neighbours to let them know what's happening and who to contact if there is a problem, so that you have them working with you rather than getting upset and possibly causing problems. Your site will at all times need to be kept secure from uninvited vehicle traffic and to keep trespassers out. Temporary fencing bolting together is the most common solution, and what you see here is the typical type and can be hired quite cheaply. Walk alongside the metal fencing to the end. You should see a yellow cement mixer in front of you. You can see all sorts of small plant and equipment as you walk along, but of course, these are just a few of the items you may find on any site. If your project is large and you're undertaking much of the work yourself, it's sometimes more cost-effective to buy brand new or second-hand equipment rather than hire plant or tools for an extended period. For reasons of health and safety and efficiency, most heavy plant is hired with an operator. If you're the project manager of the site, you should ensure that these operators are properly certified for the equipment being used. Heavy plant, like excavators and dumpers, will involve considerable delivery and collection charges, so plan their arrival on site and the work ahead so that you can use them efficiently, so they're not left idle for long and then collected a few days later. You should not start work on site, including any form of site clearance or demolition, without formally notifying the building control department. But once work begins on site, a temporary water supply is essential, and having electricity on site as well is a really good idea. Apply early to your utility companies for the provision of new services, and for any disconnections if you're demolishing a house. The principal contractor, that's your main builder, or indeed you if you're managing the project yourself, must give careful consideration to health and safety under the Construction Design and Management Regulations, which are known by the abbreviation CDM. Accidents can and do happen on construction sites, and thinking about the potential risks involved and how to minimise them is a basic health and safety requirement. Insist on basic personal protective equipment such as hard hats, safety footwear and goggles on site. You can see some scaffolding in front of you. Working at height is a major cause of injuries on site, so scaffolding must only be erected by licensed operators and should be checked regularly in line with the regulations. Now continue walking around the end of the fencing so you're standing in front of the white site hut to your right. It's useful to have some sort of site office while the build progresses. It's somewhere to shelter from inclement weather and where you can keep a copy of the drawing so everyone is using the right information. It's also a good place to keep the kettle ready for tea breaks. This example is the sort you might hire, but some self-builders use a garden shed or even an old caravan for the job. Moving along a bit, there's another big white metal box. This is a secure storage container. And again, this one has been hired specially for the job. But some self-builders will buy an old shipping container and a big padlock, which will do the job just as well. Inside and outside of this storage container, you'll see examples of typical hand and power tools and some of the specialist equipment you might need for the build. If you're doing some of the work yourself, now is a good time to treat yourself to some good quality tools that will last. And finally, for this first zone, please have a look at the site layout plan on the outside wall of the storage container. Your site will get quite busy quite quickly, and space will soon fill up, so it's important to have a plan for where everything will go. Some sites can't accommodate articulated lorries, so be sure to tell your suppliers and service companies the maximum size of the vehicle which can access your property. When planning your site layout, think about vehicle access, the installation of services, your storage containers, and a location for unloading and storing materials. Well, that's it for the first zone. Please double back on yourself and make your way to zone 2, the groundwork zone. It's marked with a pylon similar to the one you saw at the start of the tour. As you're making your way there, I'll mention the brilliant courses that the centre runs, both in the centre and online. They cover self-building, renovation, project management, energy and heating, plus a lot more, and they cover each subject in great depth. Don't forget to speak to a member of the staff at the NSBRC or follow the links on their website. Zone 2, Groundworks. Well, here we are in the Groundwork Zone. I'll be pointing out foundation and floor systems, then underground services, and finally, a bit about basements. I'm going to start by explaining the four most common foundation solutions that cover quite a few scenarios and cope with varying ground conditions as well as floor systems that can be mixed and matched to the foundation types. Before buying a plot, it's sensible to get a detailed soil survey, which will determine which type of foundation will be best for your project. Most architects and designers will go for a standard trench fill or strip footing scenario, but if soil conditions appear unstable on a brownfield site or where the ground is poor, a raft may be a good solution. Standing at the pylon, you'll see three full-scale foundation examples. They look like three big cubes. I'll start with the right hand of the three foundation examples. This is a trench-filled foundation, probably the most common form of foundation, with concrete poured into excavated trenches. It's very quick, but concrete is expensive. Before pouring, it's important to ensure that the bottom of the trench is firm and can take the weight, so there'll be no movement once the concrete has been poured. The trench depth can vary between 1 and 3 metres, depending on the initial advice from your soil survey regarding the ground composition, but the final decision will be made by the building control inspector, who must approve the trenches before they are built. Notice the polystyrene lining in this trench. This is there to absorb any movement if clay soils expand and contract, so as to protect the concrete from being put under any undue strain. On top of our trench fill foundation, we've shown a concrete suspended floor which incorporates dense concrete beams with polystyrene infill blocks. Because the floor is insulated, it can be finished with either a conventional screed or a self-leveling concrete. Good ventilation beneath the suspended floor is essential. Moving to the middle exhibit, this shows a different type of trench-based foundation. Instead of a mass concrete infill, here we use a thin strip of concrete, hence we call it a strip foundation. The thin strip that is reinforced at the bottom of the trench is built upon using blocks, which is significantly more labour-intensive than the trench fill, but obviously uses less concrete. Our two flooring options seen here both use a ground-bearing slab. On one side we show the insulation underneath the concrete, and on the other side the insulation is on top. With the insulation underneath the concrete, you can dispense with the screed which has been shown, especially if the slab itself was power floated to give a good finish. Our third foundation, at the left end of the front of this section, works a more sophisticated solution called a concrete raft, where the concrete foundation that holds up the walls is also the same concrete which forms the floor of the house. Because this concrete slab and foundation system must act as one unit, it's reinforced with metal bars specially designed by an engineer following an assessment of soil conditions on site, and the design, and of course the load of the house. Our two floors work in much the same way as they would if we had used a ground-bearing slab, inasmuch as the floor finish sits directly on top of the concrete. On the left-hand side, we've used a self-leveling concrete or screed on top of an insulating layer, and on the right-hand side, a solid wooden tongue and groove floor patterned down with insulation underneath. Now, to complete our picture, we need to move towards the back of the front of these three foundation blocks and look at the rear section in front of the basement. Look for the big blue basement waterproofing sign and make your way towards it. On the right, you can see some pretty complex foundation methods using piles, coupled with examples of ring beam floor solutions. Piles need specialist contractors and equipment and are only really used where the ground is very unstable or has very deep clay, or running sand, or even tree roots. And you'll need the help of a foundation engineer and a piling contractor to make one of these. The piling system we show here bore metal tubes into the ground, which are then filled with concrete and go down between 3 and 30 metres, or even further with specialist equipment. The piles are buried in the ground at strategic positions under load-bearing points in the house. They're then joined with some form of ring beam system. These exhibits show different types of ring beam. One is reinforced concrete, one is insulated lightweight stainless steel, and the last one is also stainless steel, but a smaller section for lighter loads. We've used suspended floors to span between these ring beams and to fill in the floors. We can see a number of different options, incorporating galvanized metal joints with solid polystyrene or reinforced solid concrete beams, and an innovative polystyrene infill block with reinforced screed on top. If you look between the piling exhibits and the foundation exhibits you saw earlier, you can see examples of screw piles. These are cheaper because they don't require specialist piling equipment to install, because they're screwed in using a specialist tool fitted to a standard JCB digger. So this versatile piling solution might be a more cost-effective option in some solutions. That's all I'm going to say about foundations at the moment, so let's look at underground services. Please make your way to the big wall in the corner of the NSBRC. Here, you can see the sort of appliances typically found in a modern home, all of which need some sort of supply, which will usually enter and leave the house underground. Continue to walk to the end of the wall and then come around yourself to the outside wall, where you can see where we've colour-coded the various services, which with what looks like a London tube map. By following the colour-coded lines through the exhibit, you can see where the services enter and leave the house, and where they eventually lead to either the main supply or storage tank on site. Things to consider include connections for ground source heat pumps, mains gas, or possibly liquefied petroleum gas. The connections for BT, all of the drainage and water requirements, including grey water recycling, water mains, foul drainage, and finally, electricity and broadband requirements. At the end of this wall, turn right, and you'll see some examples of oil storage and rainwater harvesting tanks. Keep walking past these exhibits, and at the end of the row, turn right at the cutaway rainwater tank. Here, we're about to discover the world of off-mains drainage. Turn immediately right again into the trench that runs through the exhibit. Wherever possible, you'll be expected to connect a mains drainage, but where this is not possible, an off-main solution will be required. On the right, you can see the reed bed and treatment plant. The treatment tank acts in a similar way to a septic tank. Raw sewage is deposited in this large chamber, with liquid effluent being discharged on a regular basis. The main difference, however, is that the content of your tank will become treated by the constant revolution of these electrically operated turbines covered in natural bacteria which break down the nitrates in the sewage. The revolution of the turbines transfers the liquids from one chamber to another, so the chamber on the right is where the effluent would ultimately leave the tank. We've shown it going into a reed bed tank, which is probably the most natural way to deal with sewage pollutants, as these reeds biologically deal with any remaining nitrate content. Alternatively, you may consider a septic tank, an example of which is opposite the treatment plant in this trench. A septic tank is really just a large storage collection chamber for foul sewage, which will enable the liquid to leach away to a suitable soakaway. At the far end of the trench, you'll see a grease trap. While not common in domestic installations, as there is likely to be not so much grease discharge through your system, grease in certain quantities can affect the bacterial performance of a treatment plant. Raw sewage cannot be fed through a grease trap, so a separate drain run from your kitchen and utility sinks would therefore be necessary to the treatment plant. Now, turn back on yourself and walk to the far end of the exhibit where you entered. At the end, you'll see a number of perforated land drains set in deep shingle. This is where the liquid from your septic tank would leach away. The Environment Agency strictly controls when septic tanks can be used, and new installations will need to be licensed to ensure that there's no risk of contamination of nearby water, although this can now be done by an approved installer. The septic tank needs to be emptied every 6 months or so to remove the solid deposits. Past the perforated pipes, go round the end of this exhibit and walk down the wall of the centre. And on the right, you will see a foul drainage pumping chamber. If you've got adverse slopes on your site, you may need one of these, which can pump raw sewage to a point where they can be connected to an independent treatment system or the main sewer. Now keep walking towards the large underground map graphic. And at the end, turn right across the front of it, walking over the mark lines on the floor once again, and head towards the front doorway of our basement exhibit. You'll recall that big blue basement waterproofing sign that we saw earlier. Head for that. Groundworks. Basements. Here you can see how we install a basement, which can be done using traditional blockwork and concrete, or by using one of these prefabricated panel systems. In either case, you'll first need a large excavation to create working room. When excavating to a suitable depth, you'll probably find sufficiently hard bearing ground on which your slab can be cast, but your soil conditions may demand additional preparation. The slab at the bottom of your basement will be a raft, just like the foundation raft we saw earlier. It's usually calculated by the engineer and will almost certainly contain reinforcements specific to the location of heavy loadings. Keeping water out is the main consideration, so it's good practice to install a damp-proof membrane underneath the slab, leaving plenty of overhang so that it can be connected to any tanking system introduced on the sides of the basement walls. A basement can also be constructed by making two skins of blockwork and pouring ready-mixed concrete between them. Or it is possible to create a plywood formwork and just build a reinforced concrete wall. If you're using one of the prefabricated systems, like the one shown here, these large pre-insulated panels will arrive on site and be speedily craned into position. The panels are constructed using waterproof concrete, and the jointing compound where the panel meets the slab is designed for its waterproofing properties. Regardless of the system used, when building accommodation underground, it is essential to keep out any groundwater. Basement should always be lined externally with a tanking system to meet the DPM under your slab. Unless you have a very high water table, a perimeter drain should be installed, which sometimes involve a pump bedded in porous material to take water to a higher discharge point. For backfilling against the tanking membrane, you should fit up the side of your excavation with porous material so that any water in the ground would automatically run down into the drain. Where hydrostatic pressure is high, the water may still penetrate your basement, in which case an internal waterproofing sump and pump technique should be used. Good practice in basement construction is a broad subject, and there's a great deal to understand with basement technology. But they make logical sense and attract a huge amount of interest, especially from the self-build community. My advice would be that anyone considering underground should seek professional help. Well, that's all I'm going to say about Zone 2, so let's go to Zone 3, right next to the basement exhibit. Go to the first example. You can't miss it. It's the one wrapped in a bright red breathable membrane. Zone 3. Walls and building systems. In this section, we've got 8 examples of building systems commonly used by self-builders. These examples will help you to select the most appropriate system for your project. There's no right or wrong solution, but some building systems will be more suited to your project needs. So I'll explain some of the pros and cons of each to help you decide. First up, we'll talk about timber frame. This is the example with the bright red breathable membrane in front of you. Cavity walls were introduced about 100 years ago to control the ingress of damp through solid external walls. We keep the two cavity skins separate with a clear gap in between, and the stone on the outside that you can see here is only there for the weathering and decorative purposes rather than taking any of the loading from the roof. It's the timber structure that you see which takes the weight of the roof trusses, so you can choose what to cover it with. Timber frame is an incredibly flexible system, and almost any design can be built using timber studs and panels. It's a very quick to build on site and ideal for self-building by providing a weathered shell from a specialist supplier. It allows easier project management on the site thereafter. As well as this, timber is a renewable resource. And with the appropriate insulation between the studs and in the panels, the energy performance of your building will be very high. Now, most timber frame systems use solid timber intermediate floor joists, and there's a trend towards engineered structural beams as shown here, which allow a greater span to be achieved. This means more flexibility for ground floor room layouts. They're also easier for service installations. Although timber frame can have poor acoustic quality between stories or rooms, your designer will know techniques for improving this. Remember to allow for the lead time when ordering your frame. It will take a few months to put together. And be sure that you have the funds ready to pay for it. It will be quite a hefty bill quite early on in your project. Now let's cross to the other side of the walkway and look at the second example, the passive house exhibit. Many self-builders these days are looking for energy efficiency and sustainability in their designs, and one of the leading design standards comes from the Passive House Institute. Essentially, it works on the principle that if a house is built with high levels of insulation and air tightness, then the heat generated inside the home naturally will be sufficient to keep it warm all year round without the need for a separate heating system. To keep the air fresh, a system of mechanical ventilation and heat recovery is installed as part of the design. The example shown here shows the sort of construction required using either timber frame or masonry using hollow clay blocks, although almost all building systems can be made to perform to passive house standards. If you're contemplating building a home to these exacting standards, it's essential to involve a certified passive house designer at the very earliest stages of the project. Now, let's move along to the third build system exhibit. It's the next one along on the same side of the aisle. This is green oak. Green oak is another variation on timber frame, this time using the oak post and beam construction, which is a centuries-old jointing system. The oak can be left on display internally and sometimes externally, which gives the system a lovely, authentic period look and an unmistakable wow factor. Oak requires very little maintenance. It's very strong and can last for hundreds of years. As one of the most natural resources, its carbon footprint is very low, and when all elements are being considered. Green oak construction uses unseasoned oak with a moisture content of around 20 to 25%. As it dries out, it shrinks across the grain, leaving a unique pattern of cracks known as shakes. This tendency to shrink causes some issues with keeping the structure airtight, making it challenging to meet the ever more stringent requirements of energy efficiency. This is because the frame has a tendency to move slightly as it dries out over time, creating gaps in the structure. Because of this, most oak-framed houses are now built using an encapsulation system, as we've shown here. An internal oak frame gives the aesthetic appeal, while the external timber frame, here wrapped in a green breathable membrane, wraps around the whole of the structure to give thermal performance. It's not cheap to do, but oak-framed houses in the right location can command impressive finished valuations, so the sums can add up despite the additional costs. Do think about where you might run services and cables, as there's fewer places to hide them with an oak frame. Now, let's walk across the center island corridor to the other side and look at a wall system, which looks like the top half is in dark grey stone. This is where we find the fourth example, ICF exhibit. Now, this is a modern method of construction where the structure of the house is built out of hollow polystyrene blocks known as insulated concrete formwork, or ICFs. These are filled with concrete, making a strong, airtight and highly insulated waterproof wall. Because it's waterproof, there's no need for a cavity, so there's only one leaf, so it's a single skin structure. There are important techniques involved with this method, including the metal ties which hold the polystyrene together before the concrete is inserted, and some external bracing which can be fundamental to the erection. On the inside, there's no need for additional insulation, so plasterboard is usually stuck by plaster dabbed onto the polystyrene. It's very quick to build, and openings are easy to adjust by trimming the polystyrene. Care must be taken not to end up with voids in the concrete. It's often referred to as grown-up Lego, and with a bit of training, it's the sort of system that a competent DIYer could successfully use, potentially saving thousands in labour costs. Externally, you have a number of choices, including a brick skin or an external render directly onto the polystyrene. This innovative stone slip system is glued into the face of the polystyrene. For the intermediate floor, we've shown a concrete block and beam system which should feel solid underfoot and will be lined with a battening system or appropriate clips and a plasterboard ceiling. When you select your system, make sure you can route your services within that intermediate floor. If we go back across the corridor and just look slightly to our left, you can see a variation of ICF called Durasol. Let's walk across there now. Now, some purists balk at the idea of using expanded polystyrene in modern construction because of its origins within the petrochemical industry. So this Durasol system replaces the polystyrene with shredded wood particles held together with resin. The resultant forms are used in the same way as the ICF blocks we've just seen. Let's cross back across the aisle to the sixth building system, which I think will look pretty familiar to you. This is brick and block. The brick outer skin is indeed the facade of a very traditional construction method. The external wall has a blockwork inner skin, which is connected to the external brickwork using wall ties. Blocks are an efficient way of building, being easy to work with, so that a relatively large volume of work can be undertaken in quite a short period of time. You can see how the cavity has been filled with a mineral wool bat to provide insulation. A normal size of dense single block won't meet energy regulations on its own, though, so additional insulation is usually inserted into the cavity or packed onto the inside of the blockwork by using a composite thermal board or vertical studs with insulation between. Packing out on the inside this way is also very helpful for electrical and plumbing service installations. The good thing about brick and block is that every builder knows how to use it, and the materials are widely available and competitively priced. The downside is that it can be slow to build, messy, and the finished quality is very much down to the skills of the builder. He's basically putting together an enormous jigsaw puzzle with thousands of pieces. Bad weather in winter can affect your program, as construction does have to stop in adverse conditions such as heavy rain and frost. That said, brick and block is how many of us understand houses to be built, so there's no problem getting insurance, mortgages, or even selling the property on when using such a familiar system. Let's move on to example number 7, the last exhibit on this aisle, and a variation on the traditional brick and block system we're so familiar with. This is the thin joint system, which successfully addresses many of the shortcomings of brick and block masonry construction. When you get to the exhibit, look closely between the blocks, and you'll see that instead of a traditional 10mm bed of mortar, there is a much thinner layer holding the blocks together. It's actually an adhesive that sets very quickly, allowing the walls to be built quickly and accurately. To compensate for the lack of depth in the mortar bed, the lightweight blocks are slightly oversized to allow for the traditional coursing dimensions to be maintained. The blocks are light because of the air trapped within them, which keeps the warmth inside the building, making them good insulators. The cavity is filled with insulation in the normal way. If higher thermal performance is required, this could be improved by adding insulation, either with a wider cavity or on the inside by using composite thermal plasterboard, as we have done here. If you look up, you'll see that an intermediate beam and block floor has been installed. This gives additional density, thermal mass, and soundproofing. The use of masonry allows for this to happen, as the compressive strength takes the additional weights involved with a floor like this. You couldn't realistically put a floor in like this with a timber frame property. Now, let's cross over the aisle for the last time and look at the eighth and final build system example. What you see here is a modern twist on timber framing called structural insulated panels, or SIPs for short. SIPs panels are made up of a sandwich of two pieces of oriented stranded board, which is a sort of weatherproof shipboard. It's filled with a very efficient urethane foam insulation. The panels are cut to size and delivered on site for assembly and can be put together using relatively low-skilled labour. They're very strong and carry all of the structural loads of the building. The panels go together quickly and provide a well-insulated and airtight structure at a very reasonable cost. SIPs have become a firm favourite with self-builders looking for the balance between cost and speed of build and energy efficiency. Things to remember with SIPs include prior planning, making sure alterations on site can be tricky and expensive. So spend most of your time planning and then freeze the design once it's been submitted to the SIPs manufacturer. You'll also probably need mechanical handling aids on site, as the panels can be very heavy. This completes the zone. So let's move on to our last topic. You can see the big oak roof structure nearby. It says traditional oak frame in big letters on the front of it. So let's go and stand underneath that structure. Zone 4, roofs. It's now time to think about the most appropriate roof structure for your house. From a design point of view, roofing a two-story house can be straightforward, and the design criteria will be the support, the weight of the roof tiles, and the environmental matters such as wind and snow. In more complicated designs, the roof will be used for full accommodation, so the engineer's job must include access for walkways, dormers, and roofs. In calculating the roof design, the engineer must think about the dead load, or the constant weight of the roof tiles, and the imposed load for incidental loadings like snow. A roof must not only provide a waterproof lid to your house, but through stringent energy regulations provided by building control, it ensures that only minimal heat loss is allowed through the roof. The first structure that we're standing in now is a magnificent oak roof construction. This would usually be used with an oak post and beam system, so the roof is really just an extension of the supporting structure. Using construction techniques of centuries ago, the structure incorporates long, slender oak rafters from ridge to gutter level, supported mid-span by chunky sections of oak called purlins, with a plate at the bottom and a ridge at the top. As with the rest of the oak frame, as the timber dries, it shrinks slightly, and the junctions incorporate mortise and tenon joints pegged with a solid oak dowel. As the timber shrinks, each junction tightens, making the structure exceptionally strong. On one side of the roof, you'll see from the inside a clear white ceiling behind the oak rafters, and on the other side, a green-painted, tongue and grooved softwood. The boarding in both of these locations is what's called sarking. It covers the top of all of the rafters and provides a basis for the insulation and acts as extra lateral bracing. This kind of insulation detail is called a warm roof, and it's exceptionally efficient as the thermal layer covers the whole roof with no gaps or leaks. You have the same detailing on top of the vaulted dormer ceilings. If you choose to use this system, look carefully at the detailing where the rafters meet the wall, as it's important to seal these up properly too. We'll look at the outside of this roof on our way back out, but for now, let's go up the stairs and look at the second roof. On the way up, look to the floor on your right, and if you look in the corner, you'll see that the floor comprises several layers of materials. Firstly, plywood, which is mechanically fixed into the joints with screws or nails, and there to provide initial strength, and secondly, a layer of felt, which is then covered by a rubber mat, followed by a layer of fiberboard, and then, as in this example, an oak finish on top. All of these subsequent layers literally float on top of each other without any mechanical fixings, which helps to reduce the transmission of sound from one layer to another, and ultimately through the structural joists. The continuation of these substrate materials, therefore, will drastically reduce both impact noise and any airborne sound, which is often a real problem with wooden flooring in a first floor location. At the top of the step, you enter the white painted section, which showcases a SIPS roof, constructed in the same way as the SIPS walls we saw earlier, and again incorporating a rigid foam insulation, factory bonded to two layers of oriented stranded board in a wafer construction. The panels are fabricated in large sections, and because they sit on top of the supporting rafters, we avoid cold bridging, maximizing the amount of insulation for energy-saving purposes. This sort of roof is ideally suited to properties with relatively straightforward geometry rather than complex gables. This system is a fast, quick, and efficient way to build, but you'll need a crane to lift the panels into place because they'll be very heavy. The smaller of the two roof lights you see is a traditional single-glazed attic-style roof light, which supplies natural light into a roof space, but would not be suitable for full accommodation. The second, on the other side, is the most sophisticated of roof lights available, providing an inbuilt balcony, which when open, provides a huge amount of light, and also a huge amount of glass when closed. Now, move across the steel-grey walkway to the third roof exhibit. This incorporates attic trusses. This is a truss, which is an engineered, factory-assembled, sectional slice of roof. The one here has been designed for full accommodation at first floor level. The timber sizes are calculated for their strength, and they are then fixed together using galvanized metal plates, firmly positioned by huge pressing machines in the factory. Assembling a roof using attic trusses is very quick and usually involves a crane, as the trusses themselves are heavy and awkward to lift by hand. It can often take only one day to see your roof constructed on site. Dormers are easy to incorporate, but make sure that all the proper design work is undertaken at the drawing stage, as modifications on site will cause delays and offset many of the advantages of using this system. The structural timbers are not generally left visible. The roof will usually be lined with plasterboard, then either skim plastered or taped and jointed. The insulation will sit between the rafters. It's very important to get the correct thickness and type of insulation to ensure its performance meets current regulations. The fourth and final exhibit in this zone is straight ahead of you and is not one which you can walk in. This is a conventional attic space, not designed for accommodation, but simply to support the roof covering and provide your waterproof lid. If there's a possibility of converting this space to habitable accommodation, upgrading to attic trusses during the initial build can save thousands of pounds later on, so do think about it. Nowadays, we generally use these simple Fink trusses for reasons of economy. This sort of roof may be used in a bungalow or a two- or three-story building. The insulation principles here is that the thermal layer is contained at ceiling level, and the attic is therefore above the insulation and will be cold. Any plumbing, machinery, or equipment contained within this attic space must be properly protected by lagging. The loft hatch must also be properly insulated, or it will always feel cold and possibly damp through condensation. The large box is a heat recovery and insulation heat exchange unit, with supply and exit ductwork fully lagged. This controls the supply and extraction of fresh air throughout your house, exceptionally efficiently. It retains up to 75% of the natural warmth in the air. Okay, let's go and take a look at the outside of these exhibits. Turn to face the way you entered the roofing zone and exit via the ramp on your left. Once you're on the ramp, turn and face the roofs so we can chat about the roof coverings and rainwater goods. At the bottom of the ramp, on the outside of the oak roof display, you can see elegant handmade clay tiles. Perhaps an expensive option, but quality materials like this can add significant value to your property. You only put tiles on once, so make sure you go for the best quality your budget will allow. Because the dormer roof and the main roof are of the same pitch, we can use a swept valley tile, helping the roof to look absolutely seamless. Don't underestimate the amount of work involved in creating a dormer like this, with the bonnet hip tiles, lead work to the cheeks and the exposed rafter feet, the oak fascia and the full wraparound guttering. Moving along to the second roof, that's the outside of the SIPS roof, you can see what looks like natural slate tiles, but if you look closely, they're actually made of a composite material and are flexible. You might have to actually touch them to see what I mean, because they look so realistic. Natural slate is wonderful stuff, but it can be expensive. Seeing as no one is going to be able to tell the difference without going up a ladder to check, these are a very cost-effective and long-lasting alternative. Moving to the right, into what is the outside of the attic truss section, you can see what looks like very expensive stone tiles. If these had been quarried and cut as would have been required in the traditional way, with stone tiled roofs, the cost would have been prohibitive for most of us. However, while these look like the real thing, they're actually made of reconstituted stone and weathered to look like natural stone. Look how the tiles vary in size. Small at the ridge, larger at the eaves, just like the real thing. The cost saving is enormous, yet the quality remains. Finally, on the far right, on what is the outside of the Fink Truss exhibit, you can see an example of a standing seam coated steel roof. This type of roof is very popular with self-builders, especially those constructing contemporary homes, and can often use non-ferrous materials such as zinc or even copper to make stunning designs. This steel roof comes in easily laid interlocking sheets. Once in position, they're crimped together using a special standing seam tool, which creates the distinctive ridges you can see. Notice also the rain, water and guttering systems that have been applied. We've got a number of different examples here, ranging from the very expensive, which will be the copper system, which is going to look lovely and will weather down to a natural green finish, through to pressed steel, welded and enamel coated systems, through to ironwork, and standard plastic guttering, which will be the cheaper end of the market, but which will do the job just as well. It's up to you what you want to do. It's whether your budget can stand it. It's the main reason why you would make the choice for whichever gutter you do use. But it can enhance the external appearance of your house no end. Well, ladies and gents, that concludes the educational tour. I hope you found it useful. Remember, if you want to get a bit more detail about what I've been talking about, do think about attending one of the courses run here at the centre or online. You'll find it really interesting and it could save you a lot of time and money on your project. Speak to anyone in the centre or look at the NSBRC website for more details. Thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day at the National Self-Build and Renovation Centre.